Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 26, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Larry Rasmussen. Today, he will be continuing his series on Jubilee and the Sustainable Society. Today's session number is 9 and is titled Samples from Around the World. Let's listen in.
When he came to class, there were all these tape recorders on all of the desks. And then sign on the board just says, punch the record button. So I'm grateful that you're here. I do apologize for being late. Sometimes the sessions are at 10:45, sometimes they're at 10:30, depending on the day. All right, to let the tape ministry know that we are ready to begin. And my name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is the last in the session on Jubilee and a sustainable society. Jubilee, that biblical vision of an environmentally, economically, socially, and spiritually sustainable society. It's also a vision of a sustainable society that has at the heart of it necessary periodic reform. I mean, there's an assumption that the Bible and we all know very, very well that things will go awry. One can say and mean that this nation will be founded in with a commitment to liberty and equality, but inequalities will develop and unfreedom will coexist with freedom. So there is a necessary re-beginning from time to time. Octavio Paz, a Mexican essayist poet, talks about our time as a time of necessary re-beginnings. And he says re-beginnings because you can't start from scratch anymore. In a world long underway, there's no scratch to start from. There are no absolute beginnings. We're going to have to somehow get to somewhere else from where we are. You can't just say, cancel previous memo and start at the top left-hand corner of a blank page. Doesn't go. We can radically revise what we have, and that's what Jubilee did. There were slaves, but slaves were let free. There were debts, but you forgave debts as your debts were to be forgiven. Everybody got sabbatical. The reform may be incremental, with small beginnings. If you take New Testament images, mustard seeds, yeast in the loaf, a small group of disciples, etc. All right, what is it that's pressed upon us? As I've tried to say all week, our condition may well be one. It is arguable. I think it is the case that it's unsustainable. One cannot, the earth cannot afford the modern world as an expanded state of affairs for more and more millions of people. I don't know whether what I think is the big story of the 20th century will make all of those 20th century lists that all of us are going to have to suffer now, from now till the beginning of the millennium. You know, in 1999 we're going to have lists of the big stories of the 20th century. I think the big story of the 20th century that may not make the lists is that the relationship of the human world to the rest of Earth changed fundamentally and dramatically from the onset of the 20th century to the end of the 20th century. When Boutros-Ghali addressed the Earth Summit in Rio in June of 1992, he said, "The time of the finite world has come. Nature is no longer nature in classical sense anymore. Earth is under house arrest." What was interesting is that nobody booked him for heresy. You know, called for his resignation. He actually said progress is incompatible with life. You know, and that is reason to charge one with heresy. What he meant was that techno-economic power and population numbers and levels of consumption and the cost of supporting the human species on this planet and yet permitting the rest of the creatures to live as well. Human power is sufficient to destroy the material conditions of human and other life. When the century began, neither human technology nor human numbers were powerful enough to alter planetary life systems. Human beings have always done local environmental damage. Human beings haven't threatened global or planetary life support system, the atmosphere, for example. The world of the born was not, to use E. E. Cummings' language, on a collision course with the world of the may. Nor was it true at the beginning of the century that every natural system of the planet was disintegrating. At least the rate and the extent of that did not register with people. That is to say, soil erosion at the beginning of the century was not exceeding soil formation. Or at least it wasn't noticed if in fact it was. Species extinction was not exceeding species evolution. It may have been. It didn't register with us if it was. Carbon emissions were not exceeding carbon fixation. Fish catches were not exceeding fish regeneration. Forest destruction was not exceeding forest regeneration. Fresh water use was not exceeding aquifer replenishment. Half the world's coastlines, the most densely populated, humanly populated land area, 30% of the human race lives within 30 miles of a coast. Half the world's coastlines were not imperiled at the beginning of the century. Thus, at the end of the century, a new word enters the vocabulary, unsustainability, just as some other new words or phrases enter the vocabulary, carrying capacity, the integrity of creation, sustainable development. Now, of course, this kind of centennial shift, this big story of the 20th century, an altered relationship of humanity to the rest of the planet, hasn't gone utterly unnoticed, nor have the perplexing ethical issues been left unspoken. Thoughtful observers have always acknowledged, for example, that failure to distribute nature's bounty fairly has been the perplexing social justice issue from time immemorial. Many have added that now increasing natural constraints will make that more and more difficult, explosion of human numbers and adequate production of food, or fresh water, safe water, for example. But not very many folks have noticed the challenge that occurs when you put global threats to nature's capacity both to produce for its human members and to reproduce itself. That's an added perplexity for questions of social justice and eco-justice that we haven't faced before. And previous generations didn't need to attend to it. They could engage in kind of cowboy economics. There were other pastures that you could move to. If you start thinking spaceship, it's a little different matter. There, a faulty O-ring can mean real trouble. So, only 100 years ago, at least in our consciousness, nature was still very resilient and very forgiving, and virtually inexhaustible. And we can do largely as we wish. Our social genes prepare us very poorly for our accomplishments, I think. You know. So we thought we could carry on that way. So I think the great new fact of our time is that cumulative human activity does have the power to threaten life in fundamental and unprecedented ways. And that pushes the kind of the ascendancy of ethics. Then how ought we to live under these conditions? The ought question becomes the important one. Well, someone else will have to judge whether that altered relationship to Earth is the big news story and whether the next century will judge it to be the kind of tattoo by which the 20th century is identified. Well, what ought we to do then? And today what I want to do is just gather in some of the more hopeful developments in answering that question. The re-beginnings, most of them small, that are known to us, the mustard seeds, the cadres of disciples of a new way of being human together. Some of these things may come from things that a lot of you know from having done them 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 years ago. It'll be interesting to see what comes round again as a kind of new wisdom that has been given up from the past. Should you have pig farms in Iowa of the sort that are, you know, mass-produced, industry-produced pigs rather than mixed farming, isn't it? And international markets rather than regional ones. It'll be an interesting thing to see. So I'm asking you not only what you know about in terms of conscious new efforts with bye-bye. I have to say goodbye to the family. Sorry, those folks were right. Someone met me on the trail and said, isn't your session in 15 minutes? I said, no, it's 10:45. So I said, I see my family off on the bus at 10:45 and then go to class. All right. So don't only think what is it that you know about in terms of self-conscious new efforts sustainability, whether it's in architecture, whether it's in agriculture, whether it's in the kind of thing you see around a Holden Village. Here. But also think about what kind of wisdom may have been part of your own past that has been given up in the meantime, but may well be a contribution to the future. Okay, I'm just going to list a few things, and it's not going to take very long because I want most of this session to be kind of what we sometimes call open mic at Holden and just speak right into the microphone here with what you know about. I will mention a few things. The Hamburg Environmental Institute of Hamburg, Germany, in an urban area, at the edges of an urban area, has been working with a process of a series of ponds to take care of local sewage and waste. They've been using ponds to grow aquatic plants and algae. The plants draw off excess nutrients and leave the water sufficiently safe and nutritious for fish. The plants are harvested as livestock food or are used with waste from the livestock for fertilizer in the area there for nearby fields. The fish feed on vegetables and snails that grow in the area of the ponds. Ducks and geese consume algae and provide nutrients and their own ways for the fish. And water that's purified by the process flows back into the local watershed, replenishing water supply for this suburban-urban area. And all of this has taken place just by studying carefully how local ecosystems function there before it became a mass urban area and recreating that amidst a rather heavy human settlement. This Hamburg model has now been perfected in some degree, and it's being tried in Brazil and China and India and Thailand and Vietnam. So it's getting round a bit as one effort in sustainability. A couple more and then over to you. I have some contact with the West Harlem Environmental Action because that's next door. And a friend there, Bernadette Kozar, has her own little project called The Greening of Harlem. And she gathers Harlem teenagers to reclaim vacant lots in Harlem and portions of school grounds as neighborhood and for neighborhood and school gardens. So she goes up there and she gets permission from the school to use a portion of the school ground, and then the kids are taught to become city farmers, city slickers who do their own local dude ranch farming. And what happens is that the parents tell, I mean the kids tell their parents, they take great pride in this. I mean, you start the seedlings in the schoolroom in the wintertime and you plant them. And she gets the local teenagers, many of whom don't have anything to do, or other locally unemployed people to actually build this garden, because it's got to be a raised area to get contain the dirt. You can't just dump a couple loads of dirt on the playground. Got to be a bordered thing, so and they are taught kind of some basic carpentry skills in the meantime. Then what has happened is that the kids have told their parents about it, and Bernadette then goes to some local community meeting and says, well, why don't we get permission from the city to use that vacant lot and make a community garden there. So the neighborhood starts doing it, and again you get people who have skills and people who don't have skills helping one another. And it's one way also to get rid of some drug traffic, because oftentimes it's those local vacant lots that are the scene of not just the throwaway society, but of thrown away human lives as well. And the community building side of this becomes terribly important, because people take pride in having a beautiful space in an otherwise rather degraded area. And they end up setting up little patrols, people looking out their windows and watching the activity there, so that those don't become scenes of crime, as well as growing everything, from food to herbs, everything from dyes to materials for potpourris to put a house in tomato reserve. And I like what she says, quote, nature doesn't make people wild, it doesn't make people uncivilized, but I think that concrete, asphalt, and steel do. It makes people hard, and they make people cold. It makes people unhuman. We've got to figure a way to bring nature back into our cities. Well, she's absolutely right about that, because for the first time in human history now, at the end of this century, it's another one of the big changes. The majority of people will live in urban areas. It's never happened before. Only 140 years ago in this country, more than half of the United States population earned its living on the farm. Now it's 3%. That doesn't mean 97% live in urban areas. I'm not saying that. A lot of people live in rural areas, but the transfer there. So she's right. If we don't find a way to make cities green, you've lost the battle. You've lost something about being human. And that's what she's saying. All right. In Costa Rica, a dozen peasant farmers came together in 1988 to form the San Miguel Association for Conservation and Development. That was their attempt to keep local forests under the control of local communities. They managed to find incentives for local people to harvest and process wood sustainably and to develop regional markets for the wood products. Now, in a country with Central America's highest rate of deforestation at the hands of big international logging companies that have been buying out small local landowners, this was a turnaround. And this association of the San Miguel Association has since developed nurseries for native tree stock and for educating neighboring villagers in sustainable forestry. In India, the Deccan Development Society of Andhra Pradesh organizes communities of women in villages that work toward gender equality, establish credit programs, cultivate and use medicinal herbs, incorporate organic gardening techniques, and multiple cropping into local agricultural practices, and plant trees. And in Kenya, Wangari Maathai has done the same with communities of women in reforesting Kenya. In Burkina Faso in Central Africa, a group was formed called the Land Resource Management. They found a way for 240 marginal villages to transform 10,000 hectares of previously unproductive dry land in such a manner that the previous average family food deficit of 645 kilograms a year has been turned into 150 kilogram surplus. They're now producing more food than families actually minimally need. The key was combining some systematic agricultural surveys with the process by which villagers covered the area with a series of very small miniature dams and small-scale irrigation and embankment system that they designed themselves together with manure composting units that they designed in order to fertilize previously unfertilized crops. On a very different scale altogether, and I'm just trying to give you some range here, Japan, on a national basis, through its Ministry of International Trade and Industry, established an institute called the Institute of Innovative Technology. I'm fascinated by the statement of purpose. The purpose of this is, quote, to undo the damage done to the earth over the past two centuries since the Industrial Revolution. They won't get that done, but more power to them. The Institute is exploring alternatives to chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, and trying to develop biodegradable plastics, hydrogen-producing bacteria, carbon dioxide scrubbers so we don't have global warming issues, genetically engineered algae for higher efficiency photosynthesis, etc. It's a kind of the high-tech way to find out how one lives with the cycles and rhythms of nature. One last example. The Emilia Romagna district of northern Italy has done some interesting things in manufacturing and human scale that's also earth-friendly manufacturing. Rather astounding results. Over the last 25 years, they've decentralized what they call flexible manufacturing networks that have created 20,000 new jobs in northern Italy. The wage rates are 175% above the Italian average now. And that region itself, in terms of its economic measurements, has moved from 17th in Italy in 1970 to second in 1995 in per capita income. Of 21 regions, 17th to the second. Now the regions, and it was done chiefly by changing the size and the shape of manufacturing. Now the region has more than 325,000 small firms, 90,000 of those firms in manufacturing. At the same, 90% of those firms employ fewer than 22 persons each, with most of the manufacturing firms employing fewer than 5 persons. What they did is that they pooled highly trained artisans who have developed a wide range of impressive technologies that are at the service of trade associations. So all of these tiny little manufacturing groups belong to trade associations, and then they've got this bank of flexible manufacturing knowledge that they relate to. And it's a highly dynamic, highly responsive then to markets, renewable, resilient, I should say, etc. Okay. All right. Let me turn this over to you. What else do you know about, or what things from your own past now look like contributions to sustainability? Very small, maybe large, whatever. You know about Curitiba, huh?
Yeah.
I don't. So say something about Curitiba.
Curitiba is a city in Brazil that was a showcase. It was one of the elements in the International Conference on Ecology that I went to in Rio. It's a city that has had a mayor who's a former architect, and he's been a mayor for about 20 years. And he began by reorganizing the city to look at how people move within the city to try to alleviate the first. His first challenge was to deal with the traffic and the decay of the air quality there. And so first they basically revamped from the bottom up the bus system. They first looked at all of the sort of heavy rail solutions of mass transit and realized that it was completely not cost effective. So they focused on the bus system, made it much quicker, much more streamlined, much more amenable for people to use it, and it has become an integral part of the city. And over the last 20 years since he implemented the beginnings of this, the city's growth has been transformed such that it has built up along those lines, and the densities have increased, and the amount of traffic has decreased. And it has become a model, I mean, simply from the transportation aspect. Other programs that he's implemented have included things like a recycling program initiated through the schools, where there are amusement parks in the city. There's an amusement park, and they will grant credits to children for a certain amount of renewable and recyclable materials that they bring in. Mm-hmm. And so the children are starting it, and their parents are supporting it because it's giving their kids something to do, and it's allowing them, it's giving them rewards on their level. And the families are starting to participate in a broader level. There are city parks where they're developing playground equipment and actual public space structures that are built with recyclable materials and with community participation, with similar sorts of barter-based reward systems, with contributions made by various businesses in the community. So it began with attacking a single problem of just the pollution aspect, and it spread into an entire effort to raise the quality of the entire city's spaces and operations. Huh. And it's the mayor, his name is Jaime Lerner, and he attends conferences all over the planet. People cannot get enough of him. Yeah. And hopefully, you know, lots of places he's being heard and things are being implemented.
Yeah, the only reason I knew about it is because there were special trips offered from Rio to Curitiba from the Earth Summit for people who wanted to go to see how a city had made such a turnaround. And
no, it's an inland city.
And another important aspect about it, it's not a rich city. I mean, you're not talking about wealth doing all of this.
And one of the other things I think they've done is that if they turn in recyclable things, they can get tickets to the amusement park. But if you are somebody who's poor, they can turn it in and get bus tickets.
Oh.
So they have the transportation. There's a place for them to move about the city, too.
Yeah. How about Portland? Say something about Portland.
Well, it's just brief. I just mentioned it to you this morning. That in Portland, there is an urban growth boundary, which they've had for the last 10, 11 years. And when you go outside that boundary in the unincorporated areas, you have to have I think it's 10 acres at least before you can, you have to buy a 10 acre plot and you cannot subdivide it. And so it has, this last spring, and those of us from Portland know that all the things that have been going on with Metro about extending that, but they voted not to extend that urban growth boundary. And what I see, as I live within the urban growth boundary, what I see is a lot of infill. People are, I mean, the cost of housing has gone way up because there are fewer places where you can get cheap land. But the houses are being built in what were vacant lots. Multiple level houses have been built in certain areas closer to the mass transit. Areas like North Portland, which have been depressed areas, that's the only place where young couples can find a place to live at a decent price if they're willing to put in the sweat equity to improve it. And so neighborhoods are being changed.
Yeah. So. Baltimore changed its downtown neighborhoods dramatically by a similar process.
I'm also involved in a small effort so far in Portland. It's called the Institute for Sustainable Culture.
Oh.
And so far we have four groups that are working on various issues. We have a permaculture group that is trying to learn permaculture. And we've started a garden near a cooperative grocery store on a lot that has been vacant since the 20s when the house burned down. So we have a garden there. They built a pergola, which I'm not even sure what country it comes from. Do you know?
No.
It's out of wood, kind of bending, and it has sort of a circular shape. And eventually there will be bean vines that will grow over it.
Oh.
And it's a fairly small garden, but just having this really, it's really an appealing structure. Because there's lots of conversation in the neighborhood and people want to know, what is this?
Yes.
Is this a sweat lodge?
Yeah.
Is this?
Yes. Yeah.
And then also about a block away, they're going to be building a straw bale house. As far as I know, that'll be the first one in Portland. Mm-hmm. There's also one studying upper population and another group called Simple Living, which I feel is a very important aspect of the whole thing, changing values. Towards, you know, not looking at giving things up, but looking at gaining more by living, you know, putting the focus of values on relationships, on living more slowly, having time to have a relationship with nature.
And also a beautiful environment, the aesthetic, so that this is a pleasing environment. Yeah. Yes?
Yeah, I'm from a little bit further south in Oregon, in Portland, and in Salem. My background is forestry, and I talked to you a couple of times.
Yeah.
Dinging you with questions on jump to my forestry background.
Yeah, good one.
A number of things that are going on in the state of Oregon. The land use planning that you mentioned outside of the urban growth boundaries, in order to put a house in some of the lots, it's zoned for 40 acres or 80 acres or even larger. And that dates back a few years to a land use planning law that they passed, and you can imagine that the zoning boundaries and the developers are pushing those urban growth boundaries out as fast as they can, and there is some movement in the populations to try to contain those. There's a number of other things going on in the state. Forestry Department in the past couple of years finished a large study project on the salmon habitat, and as you know, the salmon are disappearing. And because they're overfished, whether they're overfished in the coastal area or in the streams or off the coast between their migration periods is some questions that we're still not sure of. But Dan Bodkin from the University of California just finished a report. There are a number of reports on the condition of salmon in the coastal areas, and it broadens more from just Oregon, but along the Washington coast and the California coast. And those are published reports. There's a number of other things going on. The University of Minnesota recently was working on putting together different areas that are doing partnerships. And Oregon has a number of partnerships, and the most famous is the one down in the southern part of the state. I don't remember the name, but it's in the Medford, Grants Pass area, and where all of the owners in an area try to resolve their problems. And some of the comments you made the other day about getting together to work out the problems locally, these partnerships are doing that. And the University of Minnesota has apparently been doing a study on that and is putting some of that together. Because I remember listing all of my, I think of it already, and sending that in.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The other thing I was going to mention, looking at utilizing the resources, there's an engineering outfit in Corvallis that goes out and does a survey in inventory on the secondary wood products. The output from one wood product firm goes to another one that utilizes those to make different products. And that they will go into a community and inventory that and try to see how those different things are utilized rather than just discarding them and shipping them up.
Yeah. A little bit like in the direction of the example I mentioned from Denmark yesterday. How do you keep passing this around?
I was impressed with Denmark with my Danish background.
Yeah. Yeah. Are some of you involved with the community agriculture movement where you've got a relationship between a small farmer at the edge of an urban area and then subscribers in an urban area, and then the subscribers in the urban area have X amount of fresh produce delivered to them from the farm, and also contribute to. I mean, may have some help in the planting, may do the delivery, may do some of the cultivation. That's rather widespread now in geographical terms. I mean, it's in Japan, it's in Europe, it's in the United States. You're involved.
We just started this year. We're a subscriber. It just started in June, so it's really new. That's really fun. For one share, it costs $250, and we go. There's a drop off in about 10 minutes, actually, by bicycle from the house.
Mm-hmm.
You go over there. It takes maybe 10 minutes to go through. They have all the bins marked with what they have that week and how many you can take. Their scales and. This particular farm has also studied biodynamic gardening. I don't know that much about it, but supposedly there's more vitamins and, you're really getting good stuff.
Yeah.
And it's really fun knowing, having it so
far. It's another one of the community creating enterprises. One of them in Minneapolis is rather successful. Was started by Dan Guntner out of Holden. I mean, he came here, was on the Holden staff, and got the idea and took it back, and has now developed this community gardening. And it's fresh produce. It's organically grown. You know what you're getting. There isn't a question that you often have when you're buying the food that's come from long those 1,500 miles away about what it is you're getting. But it also makes linkages then between rural people and urban people, and some understanding about food. It tends to focus on, of course, locally produced food. So you start asking about what is good in your area to produce. What can you work from rather than?
And you start eating more seasonally.
Yeah.
Which a lot of people believe is healthier.
Healthier, yeah, yeah. Yes, please.
Well, there's a lot of communities that have the farmers markets on, say, once a week on Saturdays in the community. They all gather in a central part of the city, and then everybody comes down and shops and gets what they need.
Yeah.
Sometimes the food is imported if it's out of season, but most of the time if it's in season, it's grown locally. And then there's a place in Janesville where, for handicapped people, they have an industry going where they have, forget now how many acres, of undercover. But they grow tomatoes by chemicals.
Uh-huh.
They have little tubes of water going in, and they grow up 8-10 feet high.
The minerals are in the water.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the tomatoes come out just perfect.
Hydroponic tomatoes.
Yeah. There's handicapped people working on it.
I live in Manhattan. There are a lot of folks in Manhattan. We've got thriving farmers markets in Manhattan. That's where I get vegetables in the farmer's market.
One other little use that Dan Guthrie's farm was put to, is being put to this summer, is Community of St. Martin also has a program for children called Peace Village. The theme this summer was human rights. And so I missed it because I've been here, but one of the things that they've done is they took the kids on a bus out to the farm and tried to give the older children a sense of what it would be like to be a poor person in an underdeveloped country. And so they had them stop like for a bus check. It was done gently. Simulations can be kind of scary.
Yes.
When they got to the farm, they had someone kind of be the overseer and, you know, kind of make the kids, you know, get a taste of what that
working
would like to be.
Were the kids working then?
It's kind of tied things together on another level.
Yeah. Work long and hard and all day and get 1/5 of the allowance, some of your usual allowance at your day's wages or something like that. Yeah. I mean, education, that's a wonderful educational dimension of this.
I'm wondering, I grew up in a community in North Dakota, which is pretty unique, I think, and it's still unique because it has retained the economic system of a bunch of interlinked cooperatives.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's gone by the wayside in Minnesota because of corporate farming.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think that I think that because of the unique geography of this little 50 square mile location, that the cooperatives still exist. I think cooperatives can still exist in other areas if you're smart about the geography of the area that you're living in.
Mm.
I'm just starting to think about that, but. I really think that cooperative, I don't know if everybody knows what an economic cooperative is. It's a socialist idea, but it was the lifeblood of Minnesota.
Oh, the Midwest.
The economy,
yeah.
The agriculture, the feed and grain co-ops, all those elevators that
farmers
drive
co-op.
By.
Yeah.
They're sticking out in the middle of so-called nowhere.
Yeah.
Those are cooperative economic trade agreements.
Yes.
People in the community.
That's right.
And they also, I don't know if they, well, in this community where I grew up, people produced and grew everything that they ate right there.
Uh-huh.
And it was dried or frozen or canned or whatever. And I think that wasn't too unusual 50 years ago at all. But it's very unusual today. And it is still happening to quite a large percentage. Uh-huh. In March, you're eating... kind of funky tasting carrots from last summer, but they've been kept in the cold storage. But the more people are drying their vegetables now, too, instead of just putting them in the potato cellars.
Yeah. But fortunately, the technologies have to make possible drying and other means of preserving are better than they were 50 years ago.
People are satisfied, it seems, and I think it's because it is an isolated community in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
When I was thinking about it, the only thing I remember getting was from the outside was books and stuff from the Sears catalog.
Yeah. Yes.
But they're satisfied with a lower standard of living. People recycle their clothing. Nobody buys.
Yeah.
It's an odd community. I hate to talk about it because they now have a museum about their history and people are starting to, the population is increasing. It's been a level population for 50 years.
One thing we're not going to have time for, in fact, we've just got a few minutes left, that we really haven't touched on this week is what are the dimensions of sustainability that have to do with social sustainability, that is the character of the society, not just how does it relate its own provision for its own material well-being, its economics, but what is the quality of life as measured by the interaction of groups in the society. And the social sustainability is as important a dimension to attaining sustainability as is preserving a healthy environment in some respects. Which is another way of saying this is that you could have reasonably healthy physical environment. But if you've got wide disparities between rich and poor, if you've got mass social injustice, or if you've got the kind of society where nobody needs any other single human being needs to ask him for help. Right, and you got your own washer and your dryer. I mean, it's what one sociologist called the pursuit of loneliness. you just don't need to ask another solitary human being for anything. There isn't a rich social capital, if you want to use that language. Robert, what's his name? The guy that wrote this recent article called "Bowling Alone." He noticed something. He noticed that the number of bowling leagues was going down, and the number of people bowling alone was going up. And so he started asking, why is this? And he found a condition where there's just less and less human interaction and an increasingly humanly stale society. You know, I mean, and that's why everybody talks about community these days. It's a sure sign that it doesn't exist. I mean, that's the reason why it gets on the docket so many places. So we got bowling alone. So the social dimensions of sustainability, as you were kind of describing the character of the neighborhood. And again, important factor there is that it doesn't take a lot of wealth to have a socially rich community. So
we're musicians.
You make your fun together. You make sure. Yes.
I have a kind of dilemma. I guess what I've heard you say the last three classes I've been able to attend. Mm-hmm. The dilemma that I'm hearing is that you're saying it's better to have local control or regional control for things. And are there some issues that are so big that need more than that?
Yeah.
The situation I'm thinking of is I live here in Eastern Washington, and we have this wonderful river, the Columbia River, and there's a 50-mile stretch called the Hanford Reach that is as it was. And it's pretty much everybody's agreed now to save the Hanford Reach.
I see.
But it's kind of a question on how it's going to happen. And our local is bounded by four counties. And the proposed method for saving this and dealing with this situation are the local county commissioners of four counties. And quite frankly, I don't have faith in the group of four counties handling the situation. For those of you that don't know or do know, used to have the largest salmon, the Columbia River used to have the largest salmon run in the world.
Yeah.
And now it's just about nothing.
Yeah.
And this Hanford Reach is the only free-flowing section of the river left.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a bigger issue.
Yeah. It is. And I
and so I have a dilemma. I mean, the suggested way to deal with this is that four local counties that border on this handle.
What I tried to get into yesterday briefly with the principle of subsidiarity is not a principle that sort of favors localism per se, because a lot of these issues, environmental issues, are notorious for not respecting human boundaries. And that section of the Columbia isn't a section of its own. I mean, it belongs to a river that goes elsewhere, and it's not an issue only for those four adjoining counties. It's like the air over a particular region can't be handled just by the people living in that region. So you have to ask, what is the appropriate level of action here? And we have a lot of institution creating to do, because we haven't forged the institutions that handle these cross-border problems. And you know, there are proposals there, but this is just a whole lot of experimentation. And somehow that question needs to be raised at more inclusive levels than the four commissioners. Someone's got to say, well, this goes beyond the four counties. It's something for the states of Washington and Oregon. You know, it's the whole Columbia River has to be somehow taken into account.
It is an issue being
I would be surprised
by the counties and by the state and by the national government.
Yeah.
Mostly there's legislation in the national government to make that seem like we'll have a section of the river, you know, which would protect it for a lifetime. The counties that we feel that if the counties get involved, that's just going to be from an election. It's going to be protected from election to election to election. But that's a possibility.
Yeah.
And we have some friends that favor that solution.
Yeah. I want to bring some things to a close here, since our time is virtually up. The other thing besides sort of the social dimensions of sustainability the other matter that we haven't really talked about are kind of the deeper theological issues that you get to when you start probing the sustainability issues. And I think a lot of our thinking about moving from unsustainability to sustainability does come down to some pretty important judgments, especially about the nature of human nature and what's possible, what's likely to work, what's not likely to work, etc. What kind of scale of responsibility do people handle well? What kinds don't they handle well? And I will just use a summary from David Orr, who's an educator in ecology, wrote an important book called Ecological Literacy, as his own set of four things to keep in mind for the transition to sustainable community. And these, like I said, oftentimes they're for us rooted in theological judgments about human nature. First, people are finite and fallible. Our capacity to understand complexity and large scale, much less to manage it, is limited. Things too big are a liability. Second, a sustainable world can be put together only from the bottom up. The building units are communities and communities of communities. The social capital of smaller networks enabling larger networks is crucial. The argument in my other book on moral fragments and moral community is that the very efforts we had at cosmopolitan ethic in the Enlightenment and global institutions never reproduced the moral foundations that they required for their own success. Because things that big can't do what only intimate communities can. Families, neighborhoods, face-to-face relationships. So you shouldn't build institutions that you should build from communities of communities so that you've got a continual working away at the cultivation of proper social capital. Third, the crucial knowledge is knowledge that co-evolves from culture and nature together in a given locale. Remembering that locale in a crowded world full of life and under house arrest has different dimensions. Locale may be in an immediate neighborhood. It may also mean how do we deal as a planet with the ozone layer. So I don't know. But what, in any case, the crucial knowledge is knowledge that co-evolves from culture and nature together. Lastly, the true harvest for ongoing evolution is embedded in nature's own designs. Nature is not, first of all, a big bank of resources standing at the ready. It's a source and model for the very designs that we must draw upon in order to address the problems we face. Learning to fit into nature's patterns is architectonic of all else we would do. That's what I tried to say the other day by saying, in the end, the laws of economics have to be the same as the laws of ecology, because each and every economic system is totally and utterly dependent, finally, upon the economy of nature. So learning nature's patterns is architectonic of all else we would do. It doesn't mean necessarily mimicking them. I often tell the students, nature is always a teacher, it's not always a teacher of morality. It's too casual about a lot of suffering. So I don't mean simply mimicking nature, but we can't possibly go to the other extreme of just being oblivious and thinking that nature is simply plastic for human design. Then, second thing in summary, some norms. I put them on the board, and I won't do that again now because our time is up. But some norms, if we tried to take all of the examples we talked about today and a whole lot of others and said, now what is it about these, what kind of things should you keep in mind all the way through for moving into new experiments or other experiments? And what are, in my, with my special concern for kind of the moral norms, the quality of life, the way of life, and its viability, what should you keep in mind? I'll just, again, go through these. Sufficiency as one norm. That's a commitment to meet the basic material needs of all life possible. It means sufficiency for both humankind and other kinds' populations. It means, for humans, it means careful organization of the economics of borrowing and sharing. And I know this country won't accept it at present, but some societies have both floors and ceilings for consumption. A sufficiency revolution must accompany any technological eco-efficiency one, I would say. Well, one of the, that's an aside for another day. Equity as basic fairness is a cousin of sufficiency. Both distributive and procedural justice are needed as means to ensure global equity among nations and society, biotic equity among species so that species have a chance to live. Equity, we need to think across generations, the unborn, what we owe them, and equity between women and men. Such equity is necessary to assure that sufficiency levels are attained and sustained. And one of the interesting studies anthropologically is that stratified societies become unsustainable. Equity is really basic for sustainability. Accountability is a norm, as the sense and structuring of responsibility toward one another and Earth itself carried out in ways that people understand and can see. As I say, people know who and how decisions are made, and there are structures and procedures for holding decision makers accountable. I love Holden because everybody has to do everything. And so you learn, what other people did to contribute to your well-being. You do garbology a couple of times, and you'll be very careful about not wasting and putting your waste onto somebody else. Do dish team a couple of times. Make all of this stuff shared in one level or another, and know how things are done. It's all public, you know. It also helps a lot for getting along with one another. Material simplicity and spiritual richness are important to sustainability, markers of a quality of life. Enough bread for all, sufficiency, but life is more than bread alone. Negatively stated, major disparities of wealth and poverty generate instability and unsustainability, and so do soul-barren cultures. They are unsustainable. There's not a kind of richness of life there. Spiritual richness. Responsibility is a norm on a scale that people can handle. This is David Orr again. It's an argument for actions commensurate with workable community. It's also an argument for technologies whose consequences are more apparent rather than less. See what the consequence of using this technology is. The consequences of technologies make them smaller in their range rather than longer in their range. and subject to alteration and correction without vast disruption. And then subsidiarity is how to organize the kind of the political life. Okay. Finally, just to say that I think that the time in which we live in, and moving from unsustainability to sustainability, is one where we really need to ask how is it that people find bread for the journey? I mean, sort of moral and spiritually renewable energy. Because there's no guarantee whatsoever that life will triumph over death. That's just not a given. Where is the faith that in the face of uncertainty and in the face of the long haul is a bold, active, lively faith, to use Luther's words. The whole question of how you get renewable moral spiritual energy for the long haul in the face of uncertainty and inevitable experimentation is an important one and goes directly to the question of faith. I like Luther at this point. Understand with Luther that faith is not the human notion and dream that some people call faith, but a divine work in us which changes us and makes us to be born anew to God, a living, busy, active, mighty thing, a living, daring confidence in God's grace, making people glad and bold and happy in dealing with God and with all creatures. Now that's Martin Luther's language. Dealing with God and all creatures. Now that kind of confidence is hard won. Do you know Norman MacLean's "A River Runs Through It"? He says, "All good things come by grace, and grace comes by art, and art does not come easily." talking about learning fly fishing. Or it's like Baby Suggs in Toni Morrison's "Beloved," where she says to the slaves that the only grace that they can have is the grace that they can imagine. If they cannot see it, they cannot have it. So it doesn't come easily. But finish with Maya Angelou's poem. By grace, through such faith. This is Luther now. We will, with these stories, we've been raised on a mess of stories, but then at some point the heart writes its own, and we're in a time where we're going to have to write some of our own stories. And when we do, we might experience what Maya Angelou talks about as the pulse of a new day when we listen to unexpected stories of earth and unexpected stories of the heart. And when we do, we'll have the grace to look up and out, quoting her, and into our sister's eyes and into our brother's face, our country, the planet, and say very simply, with hope, good morning. It's a nice piece. Thank you.